I'm Judy Helgen. I'm here with my husband Verlin, who's doing the, Verlin Smith, who's been doing the Bible study, as most of you know. What I want to talk about today, or I'd like to have it be kind of a discussion more than me talking at you. For one thing, I'm not a theologian, I'm a biologist. So I've read some books, but I'm not really an expert in theology. So what I'd like to do is do this as a discussion. I have a handout for us to look at near the end. I have some material from Joe Sittler's book, Nature and Grace, and from Sally McFaig's newer book called Super, Natural Christians that I'd like to elevate. So those would be the two authors that we would look at in a little bit more detail. The first thing, Verlin said people don't know what cosmology is, so they probably think it's something to do with, I don't know, reading the stars or, you know, tarot cards or something, which I never do.
Reading palms.
I'm into science, not sort of superstitious things, but cosmology really means where we fit into the scheme of things. You know, where do we fit into the whole universe? One definition is, cosmology is our creation story. It's how we see our place in the universe, where we fit in, and how we see and interpret reality. So that's kind of the overall place where I'm coming from. Part of what got me started was there were some writers who were almost attacking Christianity for being very anthropocentric and pulling people away from connection with the earth, maybe out of a fear of worshiping nature rather than God, and that attitude actually has been part of the reason why we have allowed the earth's environment to deteriorate. Mm-hmm. So that, you know, there have been criticisms that have come out from a number of authors. So the first thing I thought we'd do is put together a cosmology from the older view. Does anybody know, you know about the great chain of being? And that you have, I think I'll use this one for this. What would be on the top in the older cosmology, or the cosmology that really was in the, say, the Middle Ages, that is somewhat reinterpreted now? We had a chain of being where we had God at the top. Get this work, and then they would put the angels right in next, and humans, although this was broken down with men and women, and they did have children below, underneath.
Below humans?
Well, there was a rank ordering. Everybody had a place, so I'm just saying there were some rank orderings, male, female, and children. And then we had animals, and then plants, and then I think sometimes they put at the bottom, they put water, soil, air, just as examples of inanimate life. Sometimes you see this pictured in kind of a triangle. And there was a divide in this model. There was a divide where you had things above the line had spirit, and things below the line were non-spiritual. So what would that do, or how would that make people relate, or what would that do to the relationship between people and things in this non-spiritual world?
Or more important, or
which is more important?
The top one.
The top one's more important, or the rulers, or
does intellect work in with that spirit? Is that a part of that, or is it strictly a spiritual thing we're talking about? Are we talking about reasoning?
Yeah, I'm not. You're not familiar enough with that. No. I think it was more soul and spirit.
Okay.
Inhabited humans were between God and the non-spiritual world or earth. Mm-hmm. So they were kind of in between. So they did have spirits that they could link to God, but nothing below humans had it. So I don't know what it said about the intellectual life.
I'm going to be a devil's advocate and ask, how have they proven that animals are non-spiritual? Mm-hmm. Or plants? Or the rest of it? I mean, yeah. How do you define spirit?
Right.
Well, nothing in scripture says that God has breathed into them,
okay,
the breath of life as he did into humans.
That song that I read. Oh, there you talk about scriptures.
Scripture.
Yeah, okay. That may be. This is where I don't have the background in the Bible to be able to speak to that. People who are now talking about how we need to change our relationship are talking about the breath of God going into all beings. So. Okay, what I thought we'd do now is talk about one of the other values of that scheme was that because everything had a place in the order and there was a kind of a hierarchy, that it did all hang together. And what some of the writers are talking about is as we moved into the age of mechanistic thinking, that things became, things began to fall apart. We didn't have a scheme that held things together. And now what some people are saying when we're looking at the story that science is giving us about the development of life on Earth, things are hanging together again. And what we need to look at is whether we have, where we see ourselves in nature and where we see God in nature. So let's talk a little bit about what we mean by nature. What are some ways that we describe nature or we refer to nature? Can you just give some examples?
Environment.
Okay, environment.
Not man-made, it'd be just natural or whatever you want to call it.
Okay, not man-made. What are some other ways? Or ways you think about nature?
Well, I look at nature almost at the top than at the bottom, because if we don't have those things, we're not going to be here. So I don't know how,
okay,
if there's a word for it or.
Okay, nature at the top of life? Or,
I missed out.
No, go ahead.
I missed out on who idea that pyramid is.
This was in the medieval, although I think it has carried over, I think, in people's thinking now, but it was called the Great Chain of Being.
And who was responsible for that?
Oh,
philosophers
probably. But didn't the Catholics, weren't they carrying that too?
You know, water ought to be right up there under the angels.
It should be on the top.
Everything begins with water in nature.
Well, okay, that's a view we're putting out here.
Pardon?
You're saying that for what reason?
Everything begins with water.
Okay.
There might be God and angels without water, but there wouldn't be anything else up there without water.
Another way to look at it is that broad part of the pyramid is
should be on
lower
the
and it's supporting the top part.
It does that.
Yeah, right.
So you're saying put water up at the top?
Under the angels.
Under God and angels.
Between angels and humans.
Okay, wait. Now we've got God and angels. Okay. And then have water. Okay, I like it.
that bottom part then too, that's a support system.
Okay, so you're putting all of the whole physical environment up here, really. Is that what you're saying? Soil and air, we'll just say. Okay.
Can we be creative and take that triangle out of there?
Mm-hmm.
Do we have to have subordinates? You know, do we have to? I don't know how I would graph it, but to me, that to me is dividing things up. I see things holistically, and how it's all interwoven, and how, you know, you can't put that there. For me, it would make more sense if you somehow get something together where it's all equal, but it all has different functions.
Mm-hmm.
Why does one have to be subordinate under another?
Okay. So you're looking at it as everything is part of a whole.
Yeah.
So you've got
it's a holistic approach, some sort of a circle. Yeah, it's a circle.
Where you've got everything is in here.
Yeah, everything is in there.
Okay. Let's take a side trip here and talk about some of the ways that nature is described in our culture, in our current culture, or some way that, say, animals are used, or ways we look at nature.
I think we look
good or bad. Yeah, go ahead, I'm sorry.
We look at it for material things, or...
Okay.
Or everything we need, I mean, food, clothes.
And by we, that's us.
Human.
Okay. Okay, so it's a resource for human needs. Okay.
Which includes, I think, recreation too, because you can get your, you know, horseback riding, hunting, fishing, all of that.
Okay.
Hiking.
So we're talking food.
Yeah.
Energy, yeah.
Recreation.
Aesthetics, maybe. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay. What about the Saturday morning cartoons? How about how we look at animals in our culture, just kind of in general? Just reaching towards relationships that we have with animals.
I think it can be sometimes seen as good if you're enjoying it, or bad if you have a fear about it.
Okay.
You know, like a hurricane can be seen as bad. Someone you know would die because mm-hmm. of that.
Okay.
You know, fire can be seen as, you know, it's kind of like
right.
a good bad skin,
right.
depending
right.
on how it affects you. And I think that's just one perspective that I noticed.
So it's good or destructive.
Yeah, and I definitely grew up with that perspective, and just probably the last 10 years have started to look at, like, trying to understand things and how they, the good and bad effects they have.
Okay, so the hurricane, that's Mother Nature's fury. I mean, that.
Yeah, some people.
The floods.
Yeah, some people say it's because of the global warming, and it's the way the Earth is cooling itself off.
Yeah.
You know, which
right.
is another perspective.
It is, and every time I hear someone talking about disasters like the floods, you know, you ask the question, what role did humans have in playing and
mm-hmm.
in that? Mm-hmm. So nature is destructive, but there's a question here about did we
who's
at least add to it?
That, you know.
At least we have some level of responsibility there. Okay. How do we I don't want to get into the whole animal rights issue, but what I was really fishing for was And I'll come back to it with Sally McFaig in her book, Supernatural Christians. She's talking about how we relate to animals, and it's a very important point for her in terms of are being able to begin to accept that there are other species that are other than us and that they aren't there really to serve our needs. And she goes on and talks about how we tend to sentimentalize animals or we do this, she calls it animizing. We project all of these, a lot of our most horrible characteristics onto animals, and then we put them in like the Saturday morning cartoons and have them go around beating up on people. And, or even this morning you said that Jesus called Herod a fox. You know, I kind of rather than a wily, you know, cunning. I mean, it's a historically been done, but we're put negative human qualities onto animals, and then we have a different relationship with the animals because we are seeing the wolf as, you know, having these, or spiders or snakes, having these terrible characteristics, and therefore worthy of our destruction. Mm-hmm. You know, because then we can. It's okay to destroy them. Mm-hmm. Other attitudes about nature. I wrote out a bunch of them in the last day as I was going back through my readings. One of the attitudes is nature as a stage for human history. It's a place where human history has gone on. Did you have one?
Yes, I just wanted to build just one more aspect on how we use animals as scapegoats oftentimes.
Sure.
Here is a real interesting reversal kind of thing, that Smokey the Bear, for every kid, is a very friendly guy with a hat on, you know, and he has his little signs. And I mean, Smokey is really a neat guy, but he's a bear. Mm-hmm. And when a little kid, we have teddy bears, and we take teddy bears to bed. You know, bears are cuddly, they're soft and they're furry, but they are dangerous. And it's really difficult for kids to understand that there is an element of fear that they should have towards bears when they're out, not in the city, they never meet a bear. Mm-hmm. But in reality, that is not what a bear is about.
Well, but see, let's take that another step. Is a bear a fearful creature? I mean, is a bear out to get us?
No.
Oh, well, if you're trapping.
Kind of
the stock market chooses wolves and bears.
Yeah, there's another one.
That's right. That's
and they don't back off if you let them.
Oh, yeah. I know.
But inherently, as an animal, is a bear a fearful creature out to get us?
Yes, well, if you're going to be a black bear, you better.
You threaten their young.
Know how to handle it.
Or you sneak up on them.
If you sneak up on them.
Okay. I just got a ride from Glacier National Park.
Yeah, black bears are small ones.
One of the reasons why they think grizzlies are really more aggressive is because they, over time, lived in the plains, the wide open plains, so were very vulnerable to being attacked. So they have a part of them that's more aggressive than a black bear.
Oh, that's interesting.
So there's kind of a story to why they're aggressive, more aggressive.
Okay.
But still, they'll leave you.
Yeah, they will. Right. Okay, that's it. We'll come back to that point when I go through some of Sally McVeigh's comments, but it is a distinction because, you know, what you're saying is right. The kids need to be taught careful behavior when they're out in the environment of an animal, but at the same time, what they sometimes get taught is nature is fearful and scary, and nature is there out to get you. You know, it's, remember that, what was the movie we watched as little kids with the... wasn't Cinderella, what was it? The one with the spooky trees. I just remember the spooky trees coming down at night over the little kid who was running down the path. And just that, you know, teaching kids that nature is really something to be afraid of rather than something to interact with and learn about. Like learn that the bear has reasons for its behavior and how to avoid it.
What would you say then as far as like the deer tick that causes Lyme's disease? Can you trace that to something that we've done?
We'll have to jump to how Sally McVeigh looks at this. She looks at all species having their own intentionality, their own life and needs. And so you have ticks, which, and that's one of her examples is a tick, not a deer tick, but it's perfectly fine. you have ticks which have evolved to take a blood meal from a mammal in order to produce their eggs. And so their behavior has developed that they hang on the ends of little grasses and shrubs and wait for a warm animal, usually a deer or, you know, I don't know what other kind of warm animal would pass by, to get on and get that blood meal and drop off. They don't kill the animal. Their pattern has not been one to kill the animal.
They make them pretty miserable, though.
But they make them pretty miserable, right?
They sure do that.
They don't get off soon enough. But her point, and this is very hard to move over into, you know, where she's looking at it, is that we need to respect the fact that those animals have developed these patterns, like mosquitoes taking a blood meal to produce the eggs. They've developed this pattern that has nothing to do with them going after us and trying to get us. That's the distinction she's trying to make, that in a sense we need to respect their existence. That doesn't mean we aren't going to kill a mosquito, you know, but we need to respect we need to begin to look at nature in a very different way and pay attention to kind of what their life and needs are. Mm-hmm. And she said she went so far to even say the AIDS virus is not out to get us, even though we'll do everything in our power to kill that virus. That it's just part of a life form that has evolved to parasitize cells. And that doesn't mean we let it off the hook and say, oh, well, it's natural, so we better, you know. She's not saying that, and I wouldn't be saying that. But to begin to think of kind of where the pattern of animals' lifestyles are, like the bear is a good example, too. But I like the tick one, because we immediately think of ticks, you should kill them. And I had a field work assistant who grew up in the country in Minnesota near Glenwood a couple of years ago, my wetlands projects, and Kyle, we'd be driving in we'd get back into the truck, you know, and there'd be bugs in the truck, you know, and we'd be driving along, and he'd be cranking the window. Now, this huge guy who goes out and hunts, but a huge guy would be cranking the window down and just brushing these bugs and getting them to go out the top of the window. I mean, I learned from him a respect that I honestly hadn't been sensitive to before. So now I, once in a while, will try to take a moth I find inside and, you know, go out the door.
Oh, I do that too.
Yeah, but still.
You're just in the wrong place, that's all.
Okay, got a couple others here. Let's see. One of the ones, you have maybe some background in this, where nature may be seen as a cage or a prison to be released from. Maybe some biblical passages refer to us moving away from, or transcending the earth at least, that we would be leaving the earth and leaving it behind, so that nature is really something for us to leave when we join God. That nature has no purpose except for humans. So once we leave nature, then it could just disappear. And one of the quotes that I'll read, I think from Joe Sittler, asks that question of, you know, how would we view nature if we weren't actually a part of the scene? I mean, how would we then view it? Okay, let me go on with. Another one I had was dumb nature. People tend to think of it as dumb, you know, not because it's not speaking, so it has no voice. Mother Nature, we mentioned, out to get us. God created it, but is no longer there. I'll come back to that. And Sally McFaig's attitude that we'll need to shift from seeing nature as an object to nature as a subject. So I want to kind of go through some of her writings about that, if you bear with me for a minute here. I think we'll start with Sittler first. Has anybody been able to read Nature and Grace, other than you?
Was that report reading?
For Venus Grace.
By Joe Sittler.
Joe Sittler was one of my teachers.
Nature and Grace. He's written other books, but this was sort of ahead of its time, because he wrote this in, 1972? 1972. But he does, he is a little difficult. I mean, there are some sentences that are kind of complex, but I just thought I'd read a little bit from him to give you some of his attitude. And this was in 1972. This is where in the near the end, he's Grace and a Sense for the World is the chapter that I'm reading from here. And then the subtitle is Grace and the Independence of the World as Nature. The enormous and growing body of knowledge about the structure and processes of the universe has caused contemporary theology to become silent about an issue that once preoccupied theologians. The quote, proofs for the existence of God really were intended to establish the dependence of the universe upon God. These proofs, ancient and modern, are in disarray, he says. As a result, the place and scope for the agency of God is restricted to the realms of the historical, the social, and the solitary personal. Let me just skip over here. Okay, then he's defining creation. Creation is a religious and philosophical term. It is not a term whose proper reference is simply the fact of or the possible structure and process of the world. The term creation contains and requires God, a God postulation. Until we get this through our heads and admit nature as the creation.
Yes.
Into our reflective nexus, this is where he starts to get tricky, and permit nature there to retain its intransigent reality. We shall neither theologize soberly nor be theologically guided to act constructively. He goes on. And then he has a warning about changing our, basically he's saying we need to change our cosmology. Here he's saying that we should include the whole cosmos in our theology or in our cosmology. Why should holy meaning be so dogmatically restricted to the historical drama of life as presumptuously to sweep clean of meaning the entire vast cosmic, all-engendering and all-unfolding matrix without which that life is literally inconceivable? He goes on and talks about the need for action. I want to say a couple of things that come out of his attitude about grace, and that is, and I'll read a quote, he says that grace is not separable from God. And he says that the scope of God's grace includes nature. So it's not just, you know, humans, but God's grace includes nature. And that grace is the forgiveness of sins and the givenness of life. And this is the theme that comes back with Sally McFaig, who's talking, she talks about human salvation and natural salvation as being inextricably together or entwined with each other. And he's saying, let me read that again, grace is forgiveness of sins and the givenness of life. And she talks about, and some of the others, about God always keeping life in being. So it's not something that happened back at the beginning of the universe or happened at whatever point in time you would believe that it happened. It's something that's always, it's always supporting everything, that God is always supporting everything. And therefore, he says, since nature is an expression of God's grace, that gives it intrinsic moral value. So he goes on to the ethical implications of it. Just got a couple more here. He talks about redemption. Redemption means life with God. Faith means to accept what God gives, himself as giver and himself as the gift. To be a Christian means to accept, know, enjoy, and live on this acceptance of our acceptance. He says, this redeemed life is given and matured in time and space and matter among my fellow creatures, human and non-human. And it's very interesting where someone, you know, that canticle of the sun, that St. Francis's well-known poem, he's speaking to the inanimate life, even though he had such strong relationships with animals. What he's praising as being part of God is the sun and the wind and, you know, the water, whatever, all the inanimate parts, which is really interesting. This life I have as redeemed into life with God is eternal life. I have it now, it will never cease to be. If one is redeemed, he is hidden with Christ in God. That's in quotes, hidden with Christ in God. And God does not die. When, therefore, I am saddened by the knowledge of my mortality, that sadness is both real and qualified. I am saddened by the understandable regret that so significant a person, he says, as I am, should cease to enliven mortal history. I mean, he's being funny there. But the sadness is decisively qualified by the center of faith, that the redeemed are with God and that God does not die. So he's, there's more here, but I think that's really enough to give you that point of view. And then he does say near the very end of the book, he says that we need to change. This effort to draw our regard for the world as nature into organic relation with the reality of grace is not a merely theoretical exercise. Its intention is practical. Unless some huge, primarily religious, and commanding vision of the future of the world can seize, release, and exalt our spirits free of our unregarding, arrogant, and ultimately suicidal operations with the creation, we shall continue to be bombarded by the awesome data of ecological disaster, but remain unsupplied with a theological indicative as big as the issue and an ethically unexpanded to the appropriate dimensions. So he's, I mean, this is in 1972. He's sending this big, you know, warning out. And he's not the only one, but I thought that he really puts that pretty sharply. The other book is, this book is in the bookstore. I know they have a few copies. It's Sally McVeigh's, I don't know where I think she explains where she got the title, but I find the title a little difficult. Super, comma, natural Christians. But what she's talking about is a Christian spirituality or theology of the environment. And she's, you know, what I like about her is she keeps a Christian focus. There are other writers who talk about the spirituality of the environment without, you know, without, or in extreme, Brian Swim. I've enjoyed reading the universe story, but he hardly ever mentions God in here. I mean, clearly God is this whole process, so but he doesn't really verbalize it as God. To give you some highlights from this book.
Where would you put Matthew Fox in that little grouping you just did there?
Oh, he's in creation spirituality.
Right, but I mean, you just put Swin at one point. You put.
Oh, I would put her. Him right in near her. I mean, I enjoy his writing a lot. I haven't read as much as I want to on his, but he's certainly focusing on Christianity and the need. The same similar thing that she's going to say is that we need to expand how we look at Christ's ministry to all of nature. We need to take it to the dimension of the universe and not keep it focused only on humans. I mean, that's, I think, kind of what he's saying too. The cosmic Christ is really God to me. At that point, I don't know where you draw that line. She has one. She's talking very specifically now about nature in this book, and that one of her main themes is that nature is in God. And that God is incarnate in nature. So let me give you a little bit of her flavor of what she's saying. Sometimes she's a little difficult to read. I think it's just that the sentences are kind of complex. But a Christian nature spirituality is not Christian praxis for nature, apart from or opposed to the well-being of the human oppressed. She does make a comment that some of the deep ecology, or she says some of the creation spirituality, is focusing more on the well-being of nature. That doesn't bother me a whole lot, because nobody has, you know, focused on the well-being of nature. So to have some people out there really, really talking about how the whole natural system functions, I think is okay. But anyway, so she says, a Christian nature spirituality then is not Christian praxis for nature, apart from or opposed to the well-being of the human oppressed. It is not a nature religion, a nature mysticism, or a nature ethic. It extends the paradigm of the destabilizing radical love we see in Jesus' parables, healing stories, and eating practices to nature. This kind of radical love for the vulnerable and oppressed is countercultural. It is at sharp odds with the religion of economism. She's been talking about the religion of money-making. It places the Christian in a prophetic and uncomfortable position vis-a-vis culture. It is a distinctive voice in the global ecological conversation. And she says at another point that she has a very interesting discussion about how we choose to look at nature, and that it does make a difference. And so I'll say a little bit about that. But she does say, we have a choice about how we are to interpret nature, and the choice will be very important. As Christians, then, how should we understand nature? Let me suggest two possibilities, the big answer and a small one. The big answer is that we should think of nature in terms of the picture of the physical world coming to us from postmodern science and ecology. The natural world, according to this picture, is characterized by evolutionary change and novelty, structure as well as openness, relation and interdependence. And she goes on quite a bit about that. And it's very interesting how she develops this theme of that we can share history with other organisms, but that we are actually, we have relationship or kinship with them, but at the same time we have difference. She talks about the mature self will understand that even though we share 98% of the DNA of chimpanzees, that we know that we have major differences from these animals, so that we can work with God actually providing very close connection and history, but at the same time difference and differentiation and diversity in life. A couple more here. One thing I really like in this book is that she let me just give you a little bit more on the incarnational. And incarnational theology encourages us to dare to love nature. All the different bodies, both human and those of other life forms on our earth, to find them valuable and wonderful in themselves and for themselves. This is what an incarnational view assures us, for it is all right to love nature. In fact, we should. We pray to God through knowing and thereby being able to love all the wild and wonderful diversity of creatures. The prayer is simple, vive la différence, long live the differences. She talks about, has a very interesting discussion about the ways that we see nature. She talks about what she calls the arrogant eye, and then she talks about the loving eye. And of course, she's talking about Christians being able to participate in the loving eye. Yes?
The Native Americans' viewpoint of nature, to what extent is that instructive, you know, for us?
I think it really is, but you know, I love their views. But and you know, when I was trying to pick music for doing that cosmic walk yesterday, I wanted to have specifically Christian music, because to me, I mean, they understand a connection to the earth that I think a lot of we as Christians don't. We've lost, you know, we've lost that connection, whether we have a fear of animal worship or paganism, or you know, something has happened that where we've really lost, you know, what the Native Americans have. So So often you, like at retreats and you know, people elevate Native American writings and music and spirituality, but I think it's time for Christians to, do you see what I mean? I think it's time for Christians to bring it into their worship and into their meditations and into, you know, to find ways to incorporate this point of view, which often, I mean, you know, when we go to church, I rarely hear very much about our connection to the environment or praying for, you know, praying for our responsibility to Earth or for God's
social issues.
You know, what's happening in Earth, and so. In some sense, it almost feels like sometimes when you're in a church, I mean, I'm a biologist working on the deformed frogs. You know, I sometimes, not that that should be on the sermon, but I mean, yeah. I sometimes feel like there's a huge disconnect, you know, between what I hear in the church, yeah. which is all important, and, yeah. and the plate is full. I mean, there's so much human suffering, and there's so much we need to learn, you know, how to behave, how to be good people. But I sometimes feel that, like there's such an important part that's always been a big part of my spirituality that I never or I hardly ever hear, except like I mentioned this thing at St. Catherine's last year where the St. Catherine's University in St. Paul, the sisters had a conference on spirituality and environment, and there are lots of them happening. I mean, there's science and religion conferences, there's spirituality and environment, there's a whole lot of stuff. You know, I'll diverge here. There, yes.
I think our healers so often
they
bring in.
Yes, they do. But I'm saying in the spoken word yeah. that we hear, and in the and some of the liturgies here are more inclusive of our connection to Earth. So it's there. I think someone was saying that the other night that there is a lot. I think Kristen was saying that there is a lot available. It's a question of bringing it into the church. So I guess what I'm saying, I agree on the Native American, but I think what we elevate, we ought to try to elevate through our own tradition.
I would like to just add something to your comment on having it in hymns. How many of us really, really soak in the words as we sing it? Oftentimes we're struggling with the notes. It's too, for the gentleman, it's too pitched too high. For women, it's pitched too low. You know, you're all involved in the mechanics, and very, very rarely are we, I mean, we just don't have that ability to use, well, we have, not the ability, the skill to take a hymn and use it as a prayer. We don't do that.
I thought of that last night when we sang, "Now the day is over." Mm-hmm. I thought, I'm going to write that down and use it for an evening prayer uh-huh. because it is so appropriate uh-huh. for that.
Yeah.
But so often when yeah. we sing it, we miss that
yes.
prayer. Book.
Yes. Yes, and oftentimes when you have performing, you have a soloist or the children get up and sing, people clap afterwards, and I'm in church, and this is appalling.
Yeah, let's go on. We've got just a few more minutes
all
here.
Right, I get on my
head. It's all right. I know, I agree. I agree. Let me say a little bit more about the loving eye and the arrogant eye. And in the arrogant eye is what she says that Western culture really has developed. And it's the what she calls a subject-object relationship, or you know where the subject and nature is it is, you know, so she it's a nature is a resource for us, but it's not something that we really get to know or really have a close relationship with. So she has various suggestions in the book for getting. For becoming or going over to what she calls the loving eye, which has to do with, she says, paying attention. And I thought, you know, how hard it is for people when they do the frog call survey, for me too, when the original instructions were to stand for 10 minutes by the wetland that you're surveying and listen. Now, if you went and tried that, like when we did the cosmic walk, we had 5 minutes meditation, and Verlin said afterwards, that seemed like an awful long time. 5 minutes of silence, you know. So she's talking about different ways of paying attention to nature, and that means you go outside of yourself and you learn you know, what you have locally. She's becoming very familiar with what you, and that would be the birds or the plants or the habitats that are in your local environment. Because she said you aren't going to be able to love what you don't know. So you need to get to know it. And I think the more you get to know it, then if something comes along, like a parking lot, the development is going to go in, and you know that this little wetland over here has all these neat birds and it has frogs in the spring or whatever, you may have a whole different relationship with that little bit of the earth. And so she advocates very strongly. She advocates against nature trails. She's talking about actually getting to know the plants and the animals, you know, what their names are, what their biology is, what they need to live, you know, what their needs are.
What does she think of zoos?
She doesn't like them. I'm uncomfortable with zoos.
Yeah,
only if they're actually the only place that a surviving species is being kept to reproduce.
What was your question?
The zoos. Oh, it goes along, she has that thing on sentimentalizing animals, you know, making them into cute little things. I have this awful thing about frogs that I go, you know how many frog things are in the stores? I mean, my brother gave me one of these plastic things that croaks when you walk by it. Berlin gave me a sprinkler that's a frog. And, you know, I mean, they're all over the place. And then I had this fearful thing that it's, and then the kids are putting all sorts of frog stuff on the internet. And I thought, you know, the day is going to come when we don't have any real frogs. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And people won't even pay attention because they'll have all these computer things and these Disneyland, you know.
Yeah.
It's really, you know, one of the writers talks about where we're headed is this Wonderland vision of the future. And it's sort of a Disneyland, Disney World future where we'll have imitation nature. It'll be imitation because we made it, mm-hmm. but that's what people mm-hmm. really kick mm-hmm. into. Mm-hmm.
My first name is Kermit.
Oh, no!
Before I left my last full-time parish, I had hunted for puppets of Kermit the Frog and yeah. Miss Piggy.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And that was my last children's sermon. My daughter played the part of Miss Piggy much better than I did.
There's actually one little neat Kermit book that in the middle of it, he talks about the environment and the fear of the loss of the environment for frogs. I read it at a legislative hearing. It's really compelling.
And you know, talking about being artificial, there's a gentleman in Bellingham who has just developed an artificial rock that you could put mm-hmm. in your garden, and it looks exactly mm-hmm. like the big rocks, but they don't weigh 2 tons, they weigh 5 pounds.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, there's another.
Oh, we have one of the frog sites is a woman. I love her. She's a cancer survivor, but she has created a little pond. She's dug it. You know, a lot of people are doing that. There's nothing really wrong, but in doing that, humans have a way of sort of creating little disasters.
Yeah.
You know, so she created it with the sides too steep. There's no food for the frogs. So the frogs that did grow up there, not only were they deformed for other reasons, but they were tiny because there was no place where they could feed. It was mowed right up to the top, and the slopes were this steep, and they were sandy. There was absolutely no habitat for the frogs. She shoots the wrens because they get into the birdhouse. She shoots the snakes, which naturally come to feed on the frogs that her pond creates. Then algae started developing, so they were throwing chemicals on the algae in the pond. And that was because the pond was getting so fertilized because she had a platform on top of the pond with a pulley system, and they put food on it for the ducks. So the ducks would land on this little platform and eat food and poop into the pond. And I thought, this is a little microcosm of, and I never said anything to Audrey about this because, you know, it's her view of wildness and her view of nature is this pond that she's created, but the whole thing has gone awry, you know, but as long as they have the ducks coming down and frogs, and you know, I don't know, it may end up, I don't know what the chemicals are.
What does she have against wrens?
Well, they occupy the bluebird house.
She was curious about
wrens.
She totally shoots.
Maybe she chooses what kind of wildlife she wants.
However, she's also aware, she's recovered from ovarian cancer, and she is aware that in the little area where, the area where she lives, there is a high number of ovarian cancers. And apparently she has this plotted out on a map of the watershed.
One more?
Sure. On one side of this, well, I dared to put a quote from Darwin. Let me look at that. Actually, Darwin was actually a very spiritual person. And just the top quote there from Darwin, which you can read later, but I think the point I would like to make here is that even the evolutionary story, the changes in the genetics, so that we carry the genetic memory of a lot of animals behind us, that's very well known in our protein structures. All of that is part of God's process. And it's also part of the confidence of the future. So that's why I put this in here, this continuity of life. Really, he says, here we may look forward with some confidence to a secure future of great length. And that's assuming we don't muck it up too much. And then there's a quote from Sittler that gives you his point of view. But it's really the other side that I'd like to just go through at the end here. And this is from a book by Michael Dowd, who's a UCC minister. I'm a UCC background. And he's really pulled together what a lot of other people have talked about on the cosmology. So the book is called Earth Spirit. It's actually, I think, would be a good guidebook for a study. It's very simply written, and there are questions at the end of each chapter. So I've kind of extracted this from, and he's got some diagrams for old and new cosmology that are different from what we have here. But let's just go through. Old cosmology, God is transcendent over the creation. We worship God as creator, but not as in the creation. We live on planet Earth. We are separate from nature. Now, I haven't mentioned James Nash's book, but he talks about we think of humans and nature, humans in nature rather than humans and nature, that we're in nature. And Sally McFaig talks about that we're embedded in nature as God is. We're made in God's image. We are above other life. We have souls. We are to act as stewards or caretakers of Earth. Our most important relation is with Jesus and God. Morality is in relation to humans, and law is human-centered. And some of the writers have made that point that our laws are not made for other species. And that's another whole discussion in terms of property rights and protection of other life on Earth. There is an order in being with God and Jesus at the top, and then humans, animals, plants, and the inanimate world. Okay, the new cosmology, God is the source of everything, and God is transcendent. So God is everywhere, but God is immanent and revealed in creation, including in the universe and in nature. God is embodied in the creation, physical and biological. And to me, it's so stunning to think. I'm sure we all do think about that God is in the development of the stars and the development of atoms and all the. I mean, once you go through any of the science of chemical structures, it's just impossible to think of any human, for instance, inventing DNA. I mean, if that evolved 4 billion years ago, and only, 30 years ago, Watson and Crick published the structure of that molecule. It isn't that humans suddenly created it or discovered it. It was there and created for a long time and allowed this whole diversification of life. So God is embodied in the creation, physical and biological. Earth is changing and evolving over time. God's immanence makes the process divine. Humans are an integral part of the earth. Our most important relation is with Jesus and God. To call us stewards suggests we are separate from the creation. So people are suggesting, although that has to do with caring,
We need to look at what we mean by caring. One minister I heard was talking about the shepherd image, you know, which we've used a lot, does have a little bit of this disconnect to it, that we're the shepherd is shepherding, you know, we're taking care of the sheep. We need to.
Isn't this Native American understanding that it's the mother, I mean, nature, how about you?
Well, if that mother is God, yeah.
Pardon?
For me, you know, if the mother is God, that's fine. You know, if they are worshiping a different deity, is that what you're saying? That the earth is the mother of life?
Well, do they, okay. I mean, some, I'm sure, worship nature, but does it necessarily mean that every Native American would tend to worship nature? I don't think so. But I mean, the attitude you have towards your mother is one of respect and you know, caring. Mm-hmm. I mean, she is the one that's giving you life.
Right.
And there's a sense in which we have received life from this earth. I mean, sure, God stands behind all of it, but and in it.
Right. That the point here that we're making here is that if we say we are stewards, some people are now interpreting that we're sort of separated and we're, you know, it's over here and we're, you know, there. But it's, that image doesn't apply to everyone. When you say you're a steward, when you're using Christian care, then you're caring about these other beings on earth in a way where you're willing to learn about them and figure out, like, I mean, people were feeding the squirrels up here. I mean, they're tiny things too. Figure out how, what's best, you know, what their needs really are to live their life. So the caring may mean, as Sally McFaig says, caring may mean letting them along, letting them be, you know, letting them have their life. It might not mean that we try to make the trout stream the most productive by bringing in non-native or trout that have a different genetic structure, and which actually might displace native species in the stream.
She suggests that Earth is a neighbor, as a neighbor.
Yes, a friend.
And
yeah, a friend. Yeah.
Isn't a better picture Earth as mother?
It's a good. I mean, it's a good picture. Yes, but I mean, it's particular in that it's not the whole thing as one thing that you would get to know. You would get to know all these individual things. You know, the trees that hold it, or the stream. The stream here and what it needs to recover from the mining tailings, or, you know, I mean, it's all the different entities.
So the care aspect fits better with neighbor than mother, is that what you're saying?
Yeah, or as friend. She,
friend.
Yeah, she talks about this whole relationship, you know, understanding. Paying attention enough to learn, you know, what their needs are. I mean, that is sort of motherly, but it's still applying
show as much care for my neighbor or a friend?
Yes, that's okay. Neighbor or friend?
Or?
But see, if
but
you
work as a more of a nourishing.
Yeah, you could. I mean, if you looked at the stream and the trees and the landscape as being part of your mother. I think that's good. I mean, it's a good image. But see, the only one part about it that kicks something for me is just that if the mother is providing for us, and that it's okay, but it's still not quite in the stepping back relationship that she's talking about. And then you allow these. In other words, the question is, what if we weren't here? You know, if you allow, it's a difference between seeing Earth as something that takes care of us, which is absolutely true. I mean, it's certainly the thing that drives the frog investigation. A big concern is, what does this mean for human health? So we're concerned about what the environment is doing to us. I'm concerned about the dust around here with the metals from the mining tailings, you know. But what she's talking about is even, it's another step of of then looking at nature as having its own right to exist, its own intrinsic value, even if it isn't our mother, even if it weren't our mother, and even if we didn't need it. So it's another step. I would suggest if you could wade through this book, there's a lot of good things in there because she talks about how to relate to nature in kind of some more specific ways about shifting to the loving eye. But it has to do with really, it's a heart, and she says that here. There's one place where she says that Christianity is very difficult. I don't know if I can pull that up, but it's, I don't think I can. But that it's going to be very difficult because we really do care. You know, we really are capable of having the loving eye, and it's difficult to pull back. I mean, I see that all the time in very practical things that are going on the environment.
So morality is relation to humans up above. So what position down below?
Say that again.
Well, up above there's a statement, morality is in relation to humans and law is human-centered.
Yeah.
How does she deal with that down?
Well, then, you know, the suggestion then is that we need to, we've made all of our laws for humans and that primarily around property. And we need to, you know, in fact, there's the laws that we have for species are very inadequate for protecting them. I mean, she points out we have 8% of the area of the land mass in America is wilderness. And I think only 2% of the population live in rural areas. So anyway, she's worried about the other 92% of the land. But the idea that we would think of making laws that would protect all of life is very difficult for a lot of people. I mean, look how hard it is to have government regulation and how much has been compromised. I mean, I can see it in Minnesota. You know, people want local control, which is okay, but you don't know if local control will help protect the broader life community. So we're probably a ways from having a law that actually protects what she calls planetary well-being, which would be the well-being for all of life. Yeah.
I'm curious to know how you would feel about this situation in Sioux Falls where we live. They're having a big to-do now, and in fact, the city council passed a law that they could not continue feeding the ducks on Cobra Lake because in the wintertime, people will continue to feed those ducks. Mm-hmm. And of course, the argument is that it's messy and all of this. Mm-hmm. But there's two sides that, yeah. You know, you're destroying the natural migration. And
I wouldn't feed them at all.
Yeah, you would.
Oh, we have huge problems with Canada geese in Minnesota.
Right.
I mean, they were actually endangered in the 40s until Jim Cooper worked to bring them back, and then everybody started feeding them. And people feel like this is being kind to the animals.
Yeah, well, that's what these people do.
And the other part is it's polluting the heck out of the lakes. I mean, you start feeding up Canada geese or, you know, and they're pooping all over the place and all that stuff. So all the food that those people are bringing into those animals is pollution. You know, it's polluting the lakes. And I know they're coming from a kind,
yeah.
You know, it's so wonderful to feed it. It really is neat to feed an animal. It really is. And that's what Sally McVeigh is really talking about. We have to back off and let them be. It's like at Glacier Park where you never would. When we first went there in the early 60s, you'd hardly ever see. I mean, it would be a rare thing to see the mountain goats or the sheep. Mm-hmm. And the last time I went there just a few years ago, they were down in the parking lots. Mm-hmm. And even though they've warned people not to feed them, why would they be there? I mean, they're,
yeah, right.
You know, they're down there to...
That's the same with our little squirrels.
Yeah.
The big horn sheep have come in for the parking lot.
Yeah. No, the is it the goats?
The mountain goats.
Mountain goats.
But not the big horn sheep.
No. But they're still a lot closer and they're a lot easier to see. They're coming down near the pass. We saw them on two trails. Well, I think we're out of time.
Yep.
Thank you.
Thank you.